a la compañera.
¡Onda negligente! ¡Onda criminal! ¡Suelta las ayudas! ¡Suelta las palabras!
La caravana tenía una coordinación.
The caravan had coordination. It had security protocols. The stopping points of the caravan were publicly known, and it was the police that decided to block the transit and beyond it. They put our lives at the risk of contagion.
That's Voices of the Caravan of Life, and this is San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz.
No one in Puerto Rico has received the $1,200 from the federal government. We are having problems with the local $500 that the governor said that was going to distribute. There's more than 130,000 unemployment requests that have not been filled. The same thing with people getting food stamps.
Special thanks to Democracy Now! Correspondent Juan Carlos Davila in Puerto Rico. The organizer of the Caravan for Life, Giovanni Roberto, was arrested by police during the caravan and then later released. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is working with as few people on site as possible. A majority of our amazing team is working from home. With Juan Gonzalez, I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland. At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to News Director, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
Hey, KBOO supporters, this is Kat Miao, KBOO's board president. Due to the COVID-19 crisis, KBOO has had to cancel our annual spring membership drive. Canceling such an important fundraiser was not an easy choice, but thanks to an anonymous donor, every dollar contributed now through May 31st will be matched up to $20,000. We know that times are tough right now, so we're asking those of you who are able to give to donate today at kboo.fm/give. Financial support from our listeners is what allows community radio to carry out the important role we play in times like these. Give today at our website. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Thanks for your support, and thanks for tuning in.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, activists gathered at Portland City Hall today to demand a prisoner release during the coronavirus pandemic. Governor Brown has begun to draft guidelines for reopening the state, And in national news, Amazon workers and others coordinate a one-day sick out. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 1st, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon is poised to begin reopening plans, but is it too soon? With state officials nationwide weighing in on lightening or lifting shelter-in-place guidelines, recent data from researchers at the Institute for Disease Modeling is warning of a significant spike in infection rates. Transmission of COVID-19 infections in Oregon decreased by 70% soon after the imposition of strict shelter-in-place orders that Governor Kate Brown put into effect in late March. And if those restrictions are maintained, the number of people infected will continue to decrease over the next several weeks. But according to the Institute, a quick reduction in the restrictions would result in a dramatic increase in the number of infections. The Institute's model suggests that over 9,000 Oregonians have already contracted COVID-19, nearly four times the 2,500 known cases as of Thursday. To avoid a surge, the study says that Oregon needs to reduce its restrictions slowly. It goes on to say that the state must increase its testing and expand contact tracing to keep the rate of coronavirus transmissions low. The Institute for Disease Modeling is part of Global Good Fund, an organization in partnership with Bill and Melinda Gates. Oregon health officials have used their modeling and projections in their response to the coronavirus pandemic so far. On Thursday, Oregon Governor Kate Brown released a broad draft outlining what businesses may expect as the state moves towards a reopening amid the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak. The draft follows the detailed three-phase plan the governor announced last week. Although it is not finalized, the draft shows detailed plans for the controlled reopening of restaurants and bars, retail businesses, public transit, and early childhood education, among others. In its current form, it outlines strict guidelines regarding social distancing and sanitation procedures. Employers would be instructed to familiarize themselves with symptoms of COVID-19 and suggest the screening of employees and customers. It also requires that businesses restrict the use of shared items, ensure the availability of hand washing and sanitation sites, and be prepared to stagger shifts to maintain distancing between employees. Some businesses may be advised to keep a written log of customers, along with contact information, in efforts to assist testing and tracking strategies. Tables in restaurants and bars must be spaced 6 feet apart, and seating capacity must be limited to 50% of normal. It also bans self-serve buffets and salad bars, and requires that patrons can only use single-serve packets of salt, pepper, and condiments. The draft would also require that on-site consumption, including alcohol, must be completed by 10 p.m. The draft calls for tight restrictions on the staffing and number of children present at child care facilities and requires a detailed log noting dates and times of their attendance. Retail businesses would be required to maintain strict 6-foot distancing and provide clear plastic barriers at cash registers. Stores may be also asked to encourage one-way traffic as it is currently in place in many grocery stores. Local advocacy groups rallied today around Portland City Hall, asking state and county leaders to take action for the safety of incarcerated people during the coronavirus pandemic. The protest consisted of around 80 cars, with participants staying socially distanced from each other. Zia Laboff with the group Never Again Action PDX explained how the protest was planned in order to keep people safe.
That was something that was really important to us in the entire planning process, is having public health and safety be the foremost thought in everything that we do. And that involves, in the meetup beforehand, we made sure that we were in big enough parking lots where people could always be 6 feet apart, making sure that we were able to provide supplies such as hand sanitizer, masks, gloves for everyone that's there, so we can make sure that everyone is properly secured to be out in the world. And then making, only having folks that are in cars, which is unfortunate, but not everyone is able to participate that way, but we think it's more important to show that our civil liberties are not diminished right now. We do have the ability, if we have the privilege of a car, to still voice and advocate what we need, which is something that a lot of people don't seem to understand right now when we look at the other protests, and that's something that we really wanted to distinguish ourselves from.
The fact that the protest coincides with International Workers' Day was intentional. Prison labor is still used by hospitals to do their laundry, a service for which prisoners are paid 60 cents per day. The groups argue that this is frontline work, and that the laundry service exposes prisoners and detainees to germs that compound their potential for exposure, along with the fact that adequate social distancing is not possible in prisons. Laboff explains,
"They are still being forced to do prison labor because they don't have much of another option, and that prison labor involves doing the laundry for the local hospitals that are getting the COVID patients, and then there's no disinfecting that happens between them dropping off the infected laundry and it being introduced to prisoners. And we're hearing a lot of things from inside that are just not safe at all and are a really big risk to everyone in the community, but especially to those that don't have an ability to advocate for themselves as much."
As of now, the Oregon Parole Board is considering release of 7 inmates with serious medical conditions in light of coronavirus. Over 1,000 inmates have applied for early release, but the parole board says it lacks the resources to review all the cases, and factors like age and chronic conditions like heart disease or asthma won't qualify someone for release. The groups who rallied today want action sooner, and Laboff explains that they have called upon Governor Kate Brown, Multnomah County Chair Deborah Cafori, and Multnomah County Sheriff Mike Reese to take action now.
The point around our demands with them is to really pressure to kind of take advantage of the emergency powers that they have right now, because they're more poised than ever to be able to provide funding and resources because of the emergency powers in this current time. And so that's really what we're trying to push. So with Governor Kate Brown, she has the powers of clemency to immediately release people in Oregon prisons and detention centers. For Deborah Cafori, our Multnomah County Chair, we're really asking that she has the ability to advocate for the release of everyone incarcerated in Multnomah County jails and detention centers. And then also Mike Reese, as the Multnomah County Sheriff, has the ability to right now release all the people incarcerated in Multnomah County jails. So we just want to be able to connect people to resources that they deserve to know as community members, as people that live in these areas that will be impacted by the public health crisis of what's going to happen.
According to data released by the Oregon Employment Department, an additional 28,500 residents filed for unemployment benefits last week. The report covers the week ending April 25th. That brings the total number of Oregonians who have filed to over 362,000 in the last 6 weeks. That's 1 in 7 workers in the state. The hotel and restaurant industries have been hit particularly hard, with over 60,000 claims. Not far behind are retail with 28,000 claims and manufacturing with over 22,000. Surprisingly, the second hardest hit sector, has been healthcare and social assistance, with over 35,000 layoffs. This came as a direct result of the state's order in March to discontinue non-emergency medical procedures to ensure there would not be a shortage of masks and gowns for health workers taking care of COVID-19 patients. That order was rescinded effective today, and the rehiring of many of those workers has already begun. Nationally, over 30 million Americans have now lost their job due to the coronavirus pandemic, and experts have estimated that as many as 20% of previously employed Americans will have lost their jobs by the end of April. In a related story, many Oregonians who were previously ineligible for unemployment benefits can now receive assistance. The CARES Act includes the Pandemic Assistance Program, which extends benefits to workers who have historically not been covered by unemployment insurance. This means that self-employed Oregonians can now collect unemployment for lost work. This opens the door to workers who are self-employed or independent contractors, workers that perform work that is not subject to unemployment tax, or those who did not earn enough in wages or work hours to qualify for regular unemployment. To be eligible, workers must have lost their job as a direct result of the COVID-19 pandemic. Circumstances include being sick with the virus, caring for someone sick, or being unable to work because of social distancing orders or business closure. The Oregon Employment Department began processing claims from those workers on Tuesday, and applicants can apply by email, regular mail, or fax. More information is available on the Oregon Employment Department website. According to an analysis by the Services Employee International Union, 1 in 5 Oregon healthcare workers isn't earning a living wage. For more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff with the Oregon News Service.
Oregon hospital workers are on the front lines during the COVID-19 crisis, and some remain financially vulnerable as well. A new analysis from the union SEIU Local 49 finds the median pay for 1 in 5 Oregon hospital workers isn't a living wage, and of 60,000 workers, more than 2,600 are on the state's Medicaid program, the Oregon Health Plan, despite working for a healthcare provider. Mike Morrison with SEIU Local 49 says the research found pay for some of the Providence Hospital System's top executives highlights the inequities.
They've got more than 10 CEOs who make more than $1 million a year, while the folks who are on the front lines use OHP or food stamps or SNAP to make those ends meet. And so it does leave a lot of folks saying, how are these essential workers the priority?
About 1,400 workers rely on SNAP benefits, according to the analysis. But hospitals like Providence face financial stresses of their own in the pandemic. Non-urgent procedures, which have been suspended, are a major source of funds, and Providence officials say they've lost 40% of their revenue since the crisis began. Workers paid less than a living wage and without employer-sponsored health care include nursing assistants and ER technicians, as well as cleaning and janitorial staff. The union is pushing for an additional $5 an hour hazard pay and paid leave for workers exposed to the coronavirus. Jennifer Bryant, a phlebotomist at Providence Milwaukee Hospital, says she was exposed to a patient who later tested positive for COVID-19, but didn't have access to testing herself because she wasn't showing symptoms.
It just brings a little extra stress, not knowing who you're dealing with or what they might have, and bringing it home to your family later, you know, always stressful.
Morrison says the lack of health insurance is a major barrier. He believes hospitals should cover the cost of treatment for workers or their family members if they contract the virus.
They're just so economically vulnerable that walking away from this coronavirus pandemic with a whole bunch of medical debt because they contracted coronavirus or because someone in their household did, it just can make things so much harder for these folks.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
According to the Oregon Food Bank, in the 12 months between February 2019 and this February, 860,000 people asked for food assistance. That's 1 in 5 people in Oregon and Southwest Washington. But since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, that number has skyrocketed. In a video on their website, CEO Susanna Morgan stated that the food banks in the regional network have seen an increase in demand, ranging from 50 to 70% due to the economic disruption. That means that an additional 160,000 to 540,000 people may be looking for food assistance in the weeks and months ahead. The most common causes for the food insecurity are loss of jobs, leaving individuals and families unable to pay their bills. In some cases, parents need to remain home, and school closures have shut off the meals that their kids received in school. And many individuals are unable to get unemployment or SNAP benefits because of their immigration status. Morgan told KGW that the food bank will be spending $1 million a week on food purchases and distribution through June, and the website notes that increased demand will likely continue for 12 to 18 months due to the pandemic's ongoing impact. Because of the need to quarantine and concerns about handling and storage, the food bank has asked that people temporarily halt food drives at this time and consider contributing money instead. Individuals wishing to donate or volunteer with food distribution are urged to go to www.oregonfoodbank.org. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned. At 5:30, we'll be hearing Counterspin. At 6 o'clock, Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, it's The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Tonight's weather calls for overnight showers with temperatures in the low 50s. Tomorrow, we'll see a steady rain in the morning with showers in the afternoon. Temperatures will be in the high 50s with winds from 10 to 20 miles per hour. On this day in 1931, President Herbert Hoover officially dedicated New York City's Empire State Building. The 102-story building was completed in a little over a year and was the world's tallest building for 41 years. The quote of the day is from Fay Wray, star of the original King Kong, who said of the movie, quote, "When it was over, my daughter said, oh, I felt sorry for him. He didn't want to hurt you. He liked you." workers at Amazon, Whole Foods, Target, and others staged a coordinated sick out today as part of a one-day strike to protest working conditions during the coronavirus pandemic. The action took place the day after Amazon ended its unlimited unpaid time off policy, which forces workers to go back to work or be fired for their absence. The strike was coordinated across the country and also includes grocery delivery workers from Instacart and Shipt. There have been job actions at individual Amazon warehouses and Whole Foods stores in the past, but this is the first time that workers from multiple companies struck together. Workers' dissatisfaction with these companies has been increasing for years, and the pressures associated with working during the coronavirus pandemic has forced many employees to finally take action. The strikers are looking for increased hazard pay, expanded sick leave policies, and stricter cleaning and social distancing policies. Recently, both Amazon and Target increased their wage by $2 per hour, expanded sick leave, and increased cleaning at their facilities. But strikers pointed out that these are only temporary and that in-store safety procedures are often ignored. Target workers complained that social distancing guidelines are routinely ignored and that stores are often crowded with customers. Workers at Whole Foods stores staged their first sick out on March 31st and called on colleagues to participate in today's protest. In addition to an increase in hazard pay and paid sick leave for workers who self-isolate, the strikers are demanding the closure of stores with confirmed cases of COVID-19 among store workers. To date, over 200 Whole Foods workers have tested positive for coronavirus and two have died, include one employee of the store in Northwest Portland. Instacart has hired 300,000 new shoppers in the last month, but many employees complain they have not received personal protective equipment or have received minimal kits with paper-thin masks and thermometers that did not work. 2 weeks after a shooting rampage in Nova Scotia left 23 people dead, Canada announced an immediate ban on assault weapons. In a statement, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said, quote, "These weapons were designed for one purpose and one purpose only, to kill the largest number of people in the shortest amount of time. There is no use and no place for such weapons in Canada," end quote. This means that Canadians will no longer be able to own weapons like the military-style AR-15. The weapon has also been used in a number of mass shootings in the U.S., including Sandy Hook, Connecticut, Orlando, Florida, and Parkland, Florida. The introduction of the ban fulfills a pledge that Trudeau made during last year's federal elections. The Prime Minister said that the introduction of the ban had been sidetracked by the government's focus on the coronavirus pandemic. The killer in Nova Scotia did not have a license for his weapons, and according to Royal Canadian Mounted Police, many of his guns had been smuggled into Canada from the United States. The Canadian response stands in contrast to the failure of the U.S. to ban these weapons. The U.S. has not banned these weapons from private ownership since the assault weapons ban associated with the Brady Bill expired in 2004. The list of prohibited guns includes about 1,500 models, and the government estimates that about 100,000 such weapons are legally owned by Canadians at this time. Trudeau said the government will introduce legislation to buy back the weapons, and that owners may keep them for 2 years, although they are prohibited from using, trading, or selling them. Handguns are tightly controlled in Canada, but rifles and shotguns have been more loosely controlled until now. Trudeau also said that new legislation will allow cities to ban handguns within their limits if they so choose. In an update yesterday, the Indian Health Service stated they have distributed over $1 billion in CARES Act funding. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
The Indian Health Service hosted a media call Thursday to provide updates on the agency's COVID-19 response effort. IHS Chief Medical Officer Rear Admiral Michael Tote says the agency has distributed more than $1 billion in CARES Act funding across the IHS system. He says they've expanded testing to more than 300 sites and are expanding telehealth. As of Tuesday, the IHS had tested more than 31,000 people at its 12 service regions across the country, with more than 3,000 positive results. The Navajo IHS area has the largest number of positive cases. Dr. Loretta Christensen, Chief Medical Officer of the Navajo Area IHS, says they're working around the clock to address COVID-19. Dr. Christensen says it first hit the Kayenta, Chinle, Arizona area, and in the last 2 to 3 weeks has heavily impacted the Shiprock, Gallup, New Mexico area, as they expect to see a surge in May.
We are beginning our surge both in Chinle and northern Navajo have had rapidly increasing numbers. So those are both were as predicted. We anticipate the other areas within the next week or so we'll see also a significant increase in cases. And then in Gallup Indian Medical Center, we saw a sudden large jump due to some of the unsheltered population being exposed in a congregate situation. So we had a lot of positive cases from that one event.
The Navajo Nation reported its positive numbers reached 2,141 as of Thursday, as the tribe prepares to go into a reservation-wide 57-hour weekend curfew. Two Wisconsin tribes have come out in support of the state's extension of a stay-at-home order and its plan for reopening during the coronavirus pandemic. The Menominee and Stockbridge-Munsee tribes in a statement Thursday said they'll follow the state's phased approach to reopening. Joan Delabrue is the chairperson of the governing body for the Menominee tribe. Speaking prior to the announcement, she said the tribe has followed the governor's orders.
There are probably some other things that we did that probably expanded the scope of what, you know, he did with his executive orders.
Wisconsin's governor says the state needs to see a 14-day decrease in new COVID-19 positive tests before allowing restaurants, schools, and child care centers to reopen. South Dakota's Red Ribbon Skirt Society will host an online event Friday in preparation for next week's Day of Awareness of Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. China Lockett has more.
For the past few years, an annual memorial walk has commemorated the high number of Indigenous women, children, and Two-Spirit, or LGBT people, who experience violence, are missing, or are murdered. Lily Mendoza runs the Red Ribbon Skirt Society.
It's still a major issue, and it's something that we can't forget. You know, I think we all are wrapped up in this pandemic, of course, which we need to be and be aware of what's going on. And I just don't want us to kind of forget this epidemic as well.
Mendoza offers ways for people to remember and honor victims at home.
Building a prayer altar in their homes, putting together a flower garden, maybe hanging out a red dress, maybe share a meal that day in memory of a missing and murdered Indigenous girl or woman.
The group is partnering with a youth leadership program from the Division of Indian Work in Minneapolis. Mendoza says there are plans to expand the Rapid City-based society.
We hope to put that in place and encourage other organizations that work with young women to begin to organize those Red Ribbon Skirt Societies.
The meeting is open to the public on a video chat platform, which allows up to 100 people to join. I'm China Lockett in Rapid City.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Democratic primary in Kansas and caucus in Guam take place tomorrow, and former Republican Representative Justin Amash is talking about running for president as a Libertarian. With more on the story, it's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
By the time you get to May, of course, in essence, the primary is over. Biden is the presumptive nominee. And so it would have been far more interesting and more fun to see what ranked choice voting would have produced if you had 8 or 10 candidates.
Kansas Democrats hold their first ranked choice in all-male primary tomorrow, and Burdette Loomis, longtime political science professor at the University of Kansas, is excited.
The exercise was great. I think clearly the mail-in element has worked. I think people have liked the ranked choice.
Voters can rank up to 5 candidates in order of preference on ballots due tomorrow at the Kansas Democratic Party office. Guam is also holding its Democratic caucuses. All 9 of the U.S. territory's Republican delegates went to President Donald Trump back in March. Kansas Republicans canceled their primary months ago to support Trump, but almost 40% of American adults identify as independents, according to the Pew Research Center. And some may be swayed by Republican-turned-independent Michigan Representative Justin Amash, who's launched an exploratory committee for a Libertarian bid for president.
What a candidate like Justin Amash gets nationally, you know, is it 2%, is it 3%, is it 5%?
Political strategist Joe Hunter worked for 2-time Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson. He points out that Trump carried Michigan, Amash's home state, by a razor-thin margin of just under 11,000 votes, and over 172,000 voted for Gary Johnson. So Amash could make an impact.
The important question is, what does he do in Michigan? What does he do in Wisconsin? What does he do in Pennsylvania? All it takes is to be at 5 or 6% in a couple of key states, and there lies the balance of the election.
Hunter says Amash would appeal to both, quote, never Trump Republicans, unquote, and libertarians.
The deficits, even before COVID-19 came along, were exploding. it's a little bit difficult to look at Donald Trump, in all due respect, and call him a conservative.
An Amash run could even affect former Vice President Joe Biden's choice of running mate. His campaign announced the vetting team yesterday. McClatchy, D.C. reporter Dave Catanese expects whoever Biden picks will get more scrutiny than usual due to Biden's age and choosing a woman VP.
We know that, you know, just historically, females get a different type of critique and have more sensitive political terrain to prove themselves on than men, because America is just not used to females in executive positions.
Biden and Senator Bernie Sanders have agreed Sanders will now keep his hundreds of delegates until the convention, contrary to party rules. And today, after mounting pressure from some Democrats, Biden plans to address sexual assault allegations against him by a former Senate aide, Tara Reid, on MSNBC's Morning Joe, a topic the Biden campaign has thus far almost completely ignored. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Wolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 1st, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Jeffrey Wade, Ray Bodwell, and Althea Billings. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is The Diligent Auto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220.